Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the latest efforts to free the kidnapped schoolgirls in Nigeria that might involve a prisoner swap the Nigerian government has signaled it is considering. Ni Ekwete, an independent policy researcher and analyst who previously served as executive director of Africa Action in Washington, D.C., joins us to discuss the possibility of exchanging captured Boko Haram terrorists for the kidnapped schoolgirls and what kind of military and intelligence assistance the beleaguered government of Goodluck Jonathan might be getting from the United States. Then we will speak with Matthew Rothschild, the senior editor of the Progressive magazine, where he has an article, Obama Threatens Pulitzer Prize Winner. We will look into the Obama administration's efforts to jail the New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter James Risen on federal contempt of court charges unless he releases the identity of his confidential source on a story involving a botched CIA attempt to provide Iran with a blueprint of a flawed design for a nuclear bomb. The Progressive, along with four other organizations, have generated a petition with 50,000 signatures so far in support of James Risen and his First Amendment rights. Then finally, Dr. Mark Rank, a professor of social welfare at Washington University, St. Louis, and Thomas Herschel, professor of development sociology at Cornell University, join us to discuss their new book, Chasing the American Dream, Understanding What Shapes Our Fortunes. We'll discuss the book's extraordinary finding that 4 out of 5 Americans at some time experience hunger, homelessness, and unemployment, yet we have a government dominated by politicians who serve the interests of the 1% in part because the majority of poor Americans either don't vote or vote for the interests of billionaires. And joining us now is Ni Ekwete, who's an independent policy researcher and analyst who specializes in monitoring how international affairs affect Africa and the participation of African immigrants in U.S. public policy. Previously, he served as executive director of Africa Action in Washington, D.C., and was the founder of the Democracy and Conflict Research Institute in Accra, Ghana. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ni Ekwete.
It is a pleasure to be back, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And what do you understand is this being floated by the Nigerian government that they may be considering a prisoner swap with Boko Haram? Apparently, they already have a government agency that's been set up for some time with a minister of special duties, head of an amnesty committee that had been set up by President Goodluck Jonathan last year. That's supposed to, deal with this Boko Haram insurgency and the militants that they have in custody.
Oh, I see it as a good thing in terms of the willingness to negotiate towards a prisoner swap, because I think the priority is the safety, the safe return of these almost 300 young women. That comes first. And as you mentioned, the government, the Nigerian government, has had a unit for a while, because Boko Haram has been in business for some 12 years, and they became violent some 5 years ago. They talk from both sides of their mouth, so at some point they will say, well, we want to negotiate our concerns, but they haven't. So the government set up, Jonathan's government set up a negotiating team and said it will negotiate, but it didn't go anywhere because, frankly, my opinion of Boko Haram is very low. It's been that low. I have been talking about them for 5 years. So this is not a new attitude on my part. I don't think they can be trusted and all that. But given where we are, I am glad of the international support that Nigeria is getting, because, again, I've been calling for it for 5 years. Now they are getting it. And that help needs to be used to accomplish a number of goals. But the number one topmost goal is find and return, the finding and safe return of the girls. And it seems to me the only way that can be done is through a prisoner swap, because I don't see how you rescue them, given how crazy Boko Haram is. Now, I'm no military expert, but it sounds to me like it has to be an agreement to exchange Boko Haram suspects in prison with all of the young women. Now, I don't think the rescue of the young women is the only mission to be accomplished. It's part of the mission. I think once that is done, we have to find out where Boko Haram has been getting their money from. Some suspect that even some elite Nigerians might be behind them. So I think they must be worried, because given the U.S. assets and the U.S. help, it has intelligence capabilities of finding out money flows, how Boko Haram gets its money. But I think ultimately the third goal should be, by the time that we are done, Boko Haram should cease to exist. I don't think there is any good thing about it. But the first step is negotiate with them, get the girls back safely, and then become tough on them. This is my recipe.
So, Niyokwete, though, what do you understand is going on? If assuming that there's a two-track policy here, floating the idea of negotiation and a prisoner swap, at the same time we know that Western intelligence and military assets are coming in, both from the US and the UK, don't know the extent to which what's being deployed, and don't know the extent of cooperation with the Nigerian military. When you say you've been calling for a more vigorous action against Boko Haram for 5 years, I take it there's an issue of pride, surely, from the Nigerian government that it doesn't want to admit it can't handle its own internal affairs?
You put your finger on it. So, yes, I mean, when I've been speaking, it's been directed mostly at the U.S. saying, listen, and the international community, that, you know, with my small voice and my position, is don't look at this as just a problem for only Nigeria. Because we know that these kinds of things always metastasize. It gets bigger, and they are in an area of Nigeria where if you leave the major city that they are located in, Maiduguri, within 100 miles of travel in different directions, you'll be in four different countries: Cameroon, Central Africa Republic, Chad, and Niger. So it could easily spread. But what I was calling for was just an attitude on the part of the U.S. to say, yes, this is a problem that we need to support the Nigerians in dealing with, because if it spreads, it will only become bigger and more dangerous, and it can affect us and friends of ours. But you are right. On the other side of the equation, so partly I was directing my remarks also over these 5 years at the Nigerians too, that, listen, I mean, you know, Ian, in the 5 years, by some calculations, which I happen to agree with, as many as 8,000 Nigerians have been killed by Boko Haram. 8,000. So the matter of Nigerians saying, well, this is a matter of pride, we don't want international help. I follow politics, so I can understand the political calculations behind it, but I thought it was misplaced, because I think the lives of and the terror that Boko Haram was unleashing should have made the Nigerians accept international help, but of course it didn't, so they were very sensitive to it. Now, this particular act of kidnapping close to 300 girls in school, you know, actually sort of was so heinous, and it captured the sympathy of the world. And the reaction has been so strong that it has overwhelmed a number of things, including the Nigerian position that we don't want international help. But it also has overwhelmed the reluctance of the U.S. and other international groups to say we don't want to give the Nigerians help, because it hasn't simply been that Nigeria didn't want the help. I've talked with a lot of people around Washington. I mean, about 2 months ago, I was arguing with a close friend that, listen, Boko Haram is terrible. The U.S. needs to help them. They were saying to me, well, we don't want to help them because the Nigerian military is not doing the right thing and they've been accused of violations. And I was saying, listen, this is not the first army that has been accused. Anytime there is a war, armies get accused all the time, but we have to keep our eye on who is the bad guy and what they are doing, and we have to find a way to win the war against Boko Haram, and then we can deal with the abuses of the Nigerian government.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Niyokwete, who is an independent policy researcher and analyst who specializes in monitoring how international affairs affect Africa and the participation of African immigrants in U.S. public policy. Previously, he served as executive director of Africa Action in Washington, D.C., and was the founder of the Democracy and Conflict Research Institute in Accra, Ghana. So, but there is actually a law that prevents the U.S. from sending its military in and working too closely with the Nigerian government. It's called the Leahy Amendment, named after the senator from Vermont, that forbids the U.S. Giving military assistance to countries with records of human rights abuses. And clearly there have been some. But my understanding is that the way that the Nigerian government dealt with the MEND terrorist movement in the Delta, who were interfering with the oil, which is the main source of revenue for the government, they basically bought them off, didn't they?
Yes. I mean, I think you raise a couple of interesting points. To take them backwards, yes, with MEND, it is true that they were giving money. But I do think that, you know, I have often seen people seeing parallels between MEND and Boko Haram. I don't see it, because the grievances are simply very different. MEND represents people on whose land the oil is. And when you go into the area, first of all, the wealth from under their feet is being taken away for the benefit of Americans and the Western world and elites in Abuja. And so I think they have a direct claim to say, no, we need to get some of this wealth back. Secondly, their soil and water and air is polluted. If you go to Port Harcourt, it's hard to breathe, and I was there. So I frankly don't fault the Nigerian government for, quote, buying MEND off. I think Boko Haram is very different, and I'm very unsympathetic to them, because I don't see how killing poor Nigerians is a way to protest poverty in Nigeria. I don't see how blowing up schools, killing school children, and kidnapping them is going to deal with your grievances. And Nigeria has turned to democracy 20 years ago. For the first 30 years, it was mostly a military dictatorship from the north, and Boko Haram did not arise. And so I think when a country is practicing democracy, by no means perfect democracy, no democracy is perfect, not even the U.S., but if the processes are there, you have grievances and you want to change public policy, you have peaceful means. So for me, that they have been beyond the pale. Now, a quick thing on the Leahy Amendment. You know, I think it's a great law. I mean, on so many occasions, we have actually pushed the U.S. to apply it, because we don't think it always applies it when it should, like with Rwanda, which has serially invaded directly and indirectly Congo, and yet Paul Kagame is such a darling of Washington that they don't talk about Leahy. So we've been saying implement Leahy. But the only thing I'll say is that the law actually says that the penalty of not helping a military that has committed abuses, it's applied to units, not a country, not the whole army. So you can train a battalion if that battalion has not been accused of abuses, if a different battalion has. So actually, the British and the Americans, the British are the ones taking the public view. But as we speak, they are beginning to train 650 rangers of Nigerian rangers in how to track and find the girls. They are also using sophisticated equipment and all that.
So given the violent nature of this movement and how far beyond the pale they are and how much they are usurping Islam or acting in the name of Islam, but being denounced by Islamic scholars around the world, what then would happen in any kind of rescue scenario? I imagine they've shown this video of all of the not all of the about 100 of these young women out of the almost 300 that they've taken. They've put them in hijabs and paraded them and said they've all been already converted to Islam. And by the way, I think that these girls, you know, quite a number of them are Muslim to begin with, and I don't know what the ratio of Muslim to Christian is in amongst the kidnapped girls. But anyway, the point is, surely there'll be bloodshed if there's a rescue attempt. I mean,
I mean, I think that is the big fear. That is the big unspoken fear, which is why right when we began, I said that, yes, I mean, as much as I, and again, I have been strongly opposed to Boko Haram, and but I think that the first goal should be negotiation with them to get as many of the girls as safely as we can. And one only hopes that this time they are serious, because in times past they've said that they want to negotiate, then they stop negotiating. I do think this time they will, I'm hoping, and part of me thinks that they will negotiate, because there is, first of all, I think three big things have changed. The Nigerian government now is going to, you know, shift gears and ramp up its effort because the world is watching them. Number two, you know, the international community, China, Israel, UK, France, the United States, all of them now say we are going to help Nigeria. And the third thing is what we just mentioned. All these Islamic groups and authorities and scholars who have come, that Boko Haram is beyond the pale. Here is the thing, which is what I was implying. Over the past 5 years, they have not said that. Over the past 5 years, they kept quiet. In fact, I have done more TV arguing with Muslim activists over what is going on in Central African Republic, where admittedly, the 15% of the community that is Muslim has been catching a lot of violence and horrendous violence being perpetrated against them. But these groups that I talk with globally, and they have me on debates and things, they only want to talk, and I'll say to them, that is terrible, but look at Boko Haram too. It is because these girls were kidnapped, it has changed the whole atmosphere. So now you've got a lot of these Muslim groups now saying, I'm saying before they were quiet, which is to answer your question that I hope it doesn't come to violence, but I don't think that Boko Haram now enjoys any support. One quick thing on support. You know, I try to tell people in Washington that a third factor in the Boko Haram situation, you know, the right wing says, oh, you know, they are just religious fanatics and that's how all Islam is. Some of the people in the Obama administration, especially former Assistant Secretary Johnny Carson, were saying, no, 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 it's an issue of poverty and misgovernance. And I actually thought, having lived in Nigeria and having grown up next to Nigeria and studied the area, I thought that they were also forgetting it's more or less a power struggle. And there are people in Nigeria who believe that northern elites who did not like losing power were secretly supporting Boko Haram. But the point is that since the kidnapping a month ago, things have changed. And one of the things that, Ian, I'm watching out for is U.S. support for Nigeria includes intelligence. And it's something I've been calling for, because you have to know where their money and arms are coming from. And there's been suspicion and speculation that some elite northern Nigerians might have been funding them to destabilize the government because a southerner is heading it. So we will find out who had been supporting Boko Haram. But for now, everybody, like rats on a sinking ship, those who supported them in secret are now running away, and everybody is condemning them. So I don't see them getting any sympathy. One hopes that it doesn't come to violence.
Well, Nia Kwete, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Nia Kwete, who's an independent policy researcher and analyst who specializes in monitoring how international affairs affect Africa and the participation of African immigrants in U.S. public policy. Previously, he served as executive director of Africa Action in Washington, D.C., and was the founder of the Democracy and Conflict Research Institute in Accra, Ghana. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back looking into the Obama administration's efforts to jail a New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Matthew Rothschild, who is the senior editor of the Progressive magazine, published in Madison, Wisconsin. He is one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in this country and is the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. His latest article at progressive.org is Obama Threatens Pulitzer Prize Winner. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Rothschild.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And nearly 50,000 people have signed a petition in recent days urging President Obama and Attorney General Eric Holder to end its legal moves against the New York Times reporter James Risen. This petition was initiated by five organizations, Fairness in Accuracy in Reporting FAIR, the Freedom of the Press Foundation, The Nation, RootsAction.org, and the Center for Media and Democracy, which have merged. So tell me about where the – is this falling on deaf ears so far?
Well, I sure hope not, and I urge people to go sign that petition that you can find at our website at progressive.org. If you look at my article, Obama Threatens Pulitzer Prize Winner, it's really crucial that we put pressure on Eric Holder and President Obama, because this would be a tremendous setback for freedom of speech in this country. As James Risen himself said, and he is the Pulitzer Prize winner at the New York Times, who's been writing about the CIA for years and years, as he said, you know, if this goes through, then basically they are turning journalists into an arm of the government. Any journalist can be subpoenaed by the executive branch and forced to testify against their sources. As a result, their sources are going to dry up. No one in their right mind is going to talk to a reporter, and we're going to end up knowing less and less about what our government does, and that's not where we're supposed to end up in a democracy.
So how does this compare to the case during the Bush-Cheney years of special prosecutor who was looking into the outing of the CIA officer, Valerie Plame?
Well, it's quite similar, and actually both administrations have been using their power to try to intimidate journalists and prevent the American people from finding out what's going on. Actually, James Risen was threatened by the Bush administration as well when they tried to get him to cough up his sources for his book, State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration. But ultimately, the Bush administration relented, so it's even more peculiar that the Obama administration is pursuing Risen more aggressively than the Bush administration did. And James Risen himself thinks that it was Dick Cheney who sent the Justice Department after him, because it was Risen who blew the lid off of two huge stories. One was waterboarding, and the other was the NSA spying on Americans here at home and grabbing our emails and our phone calls. That's not what they're after him for here. They're just after him for not releasing information about a source for his book, State of War, in a chapter dealing with a cockamamie plot by the CIA to give the Iranians faulty nuclear weapons material, blueprints, through the Russians. And the Russian intermediary found out instantly that this was bogus, and so the whole effort kind of exploded in the CIA's face. And so one of his sources, one of Risen's sources, talked about that in this in his book, State of War, and that's what two administrations now have been pursuing him to release. And he faces a contempt of court penalty and jail time if he refuses to release that information, unless the Obama administration drops this case.
And, of course, the idea that Dick Cheney is on this jihad against reporters is pretty ironic, because obviously it was Dick Cheney, through Scooter Libby, that outed the CIA officer Valerie Plame. And what that outing did enormous damage to the CIA, because the CIA's main job is to recruit foreign agents who, at the risk often of death, spy on their own countries, obviously for a lot of money in most cases. But nevertheless, that is the job of the CIA, to get other people in other countries to break their own laws and supply information to the United States. So after Dick Cheney outed Valerie Plame, every time the CIA tried to recruit a foreign source, the source would say to him, well, how can I trust you guys if you out your own people? What are you going to do to me? Are you going to hang me out to dry in a heartbeat?
So, right, and contrast that with this case, where James Risen was not jeopardizing U.S. security whatsoever. He was just publishing something that was embarrassing to the CIA. and they didn't want to be embarrassed by it, and so they went after him for that. It was at no risk to this country, the information he was releasing, unlike what the Bush administration did to Valerie Plante.
Again, I'm speaking with Matthew Rothschild, who's the senior editor of the Progressive magazine published in Madison, Wisconsin. He's one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in this country and is the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. His latest article at progressive.org is Obama Threatens Pulitzer Prize Winner. So specifically, the U.S. government alleges that the source for this chapter on this cockamamie scheme, as you pointed out, to get a blueprint of a nuclear weapon to the Iranians via the Russians that was, you know, designed not to work. Although when they do those things, when they mock up bogus blueprints, they often give away a lot of useful stuff because it has to look sort of credible. So the extent to which that turned out to backfire, there's probably some more to be learned about that. But in any case, the government's alleging that the source was Jeffrey Sterling, right, a former CIA employee, and the Justice Department is prosecuting Jeffrey Sterling under the Espionage Act.
Well, that's correct. And let's think about that for a second, because the Espionage Act is from 1917, and it's one of the most draconian pieces of statutes that we have on the books here. And President Obama has prosecuted, and Eric Holder has prosecuted more people under the Espionage Act than any president combined in the history of the United States. And it's not as though the allegation here that this former CIA employee was helping the enemy. That's what the Espionage Act is all about. In fact, he was trying to, if he in fact was the source, trying to help this reporter, James Risen, tell this story about how the CIA had messed up. Hardly giving information to our enemy, actually giving information to the American people, and we're supposed to be able to get that information. There's way too much secrecy in this country. More often than not, it's just stamped secret so that the government can shield itself from embarrassment. And so, you know, why is President Obama going after so many whistleblowers under the Espionage Act? It's terribly ironic and profoundly sad because President Obama, when he was running for president in 2008, vowed to restore our civil liberties, and he's hardly doing such a thing here.
So do you think that the intelligence community that's roiling from the extraordinary volume of information that Edward Snowden extracted from the NSA, and there's some doubts as to what happened to that information, and he's certainly in Russia, and he's already been in China, two countries that are not exactly friendly to the United States. Are they just sort of, is this sublimation? Is this a way to channel their anger at somebody else that they can't get their hands on?
I think so. You know, I think they'd love to get their hands on Edward Snowden. I think they'd love to charge him under the Espionage Act, as they've charged these other whistleblowers. But the fact that they've charged people with the Espionage Act lends credence to Snowden's fear that he'd be prosecuted once he steps here. So that's why he went to China first, and then that's why he's in Russia right now. And that's why people like Glenn Greenwald are saying he's got a reasonable perception that he'd be adversely prosecuted here under something as draconian as the Espionage Act. The penalty for violating that can be as much as capital punishment.
But we already have this case against Jeffrey Sterling, a former CIA employee, and they want, I guess, Risen to rat on their source in order to nail this guy. And is that where it is? Is it essentially a standoff? In other words, the government hasn't built a sufficient case against Jeffrey Sterling.
Well, they don't think they've built a sufficient case, though a lower court thought it was Risen's testimony wasn't necessary, that there was abundant evidence for the executive branch to go after this guy anyway, and called Risen's testimony just, it would be the icing on the cake. But the lower court got overruled by the appellate court. Interestingly enough, three judges on the appellate court, two of them overturned the lower court ruling, but the one who dissented was appointed both by President Clinton and by President George W. Bush, and he said that forcing James Risen to testify would be contrary to the will and the wisdom of our founders. That's pretty dramatic dissent from someone appointed also by George W. Bush.
So is this then a case that the government is really wanting the press to do their work for them. I mean, they vet these people. They get them to sign these contracts, these secrecy agreements, and they have their own counterintelligence operations. And we know how obviously inept that has been because of how much Snowden got away with. And after all, apparently back in, I think, 2009, he was caught trying to break into the Director of Operations computer when he was an IT guy working for the CIA in Geneva, Switzerland. And yet somehow or other he was able to move on to even get access to even more valuable secrets. So again, is this a case of the government basically, because they haven't done their job properly, beating up on a reporter?
I think it's partly that. I also think it's partly to intimidate journalists and to intimidate potential sources of embarrassing stories that we deserve to hear and they don't want us to hear about. This is a problem with governments around the world, and including our government. They don't want the people to know what they're doing. And in a democracy, we're supposed to know what our government is doing. It's supposed to be our government. And if they can get away with forcing James Risen to face this contempt of court verdict and actually put him to jail, he said he'd go to jail, and I admire his courage in vowing to do that. I mean, think of what a statement that would be making, that, you know, in this country where we have First Amendment protections for one industry among all the other industries, and that is journalism, they're going to put a reporter in jail for not revealing his sources. That would be extraordinary. So I think it is, rather than just being kind of lazy prosecutors and wanting journalists to do their job for them, they want to threaten journalists and chill other sources from coming to journalists.
And where does it stand since in January James Risen appealed to the Supreme Court? Where does that stand?
So right now, the Supreme Court has to decide whether it's going to take his appeal. If the Supreme Court doesn't take his appeal, the appellate court ruling will stand, forcing him either to testify about who his source was or to go to jail. If the Supreme Court, on the other hand, takes the case, then he's got a chance on appeal. But given the composition of the U.S. Supreme Court, it may not be a great chance unless he can convince one of the conservative judges or the swing Justice Kennedy to side with him. So he's in a difficult spot right now.
And if the Supreme Court doesn't take the case and the appellate decision holds, then and Risen goes to jail, it's open-ended, isn't it? It's not like you get a sentence. They keep you in jail as long as, you know, they're trying to make you sweat, aren't they? So you eventually capitulate.
Right. And people have been held for months and months on contempt of court charges. So it would be a huge embarrassment to the Obama administration and a terrible precedent, stifling freedom of press in this country if that were to happen. Carl Bernstein, the great investigative reporter, said it would do irreparable harm to investigative reporting across the nation if that happens.
So back to the petition that's already 50,000 people have signed in recent days, urging President Obama and Attorney General Eric Holder to end their legal actions against the New York Times reporter and Pulitzer Prize winner James Risen. Again, this is a petition organized by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting Fair, the Freedom of the Press Foundation, The Nation, RootsAction.org, and the Progressive Center and Center for Media and Democracy. And the Progressive and the Center for Media and Democracy have merged, have they not?
Yes, yes. We've just merged this year, and it's a tremendous combination of their great investigative reporting and activism in our 105 years of progressive journalism.
And they were the first to expose ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and the malignant influence of the Koch brothers.
Yes, they've been one of the first people to really bring that to the public's attention. They did tremendous work on this, and still are, on this question of ALEC and the power of the right-wing oligarchs in this country.
So you obviously would like more people to sign this petition. And again, how do they do that?
Well, you can go to the Progressive's website at progressive.org and look up my article, Obama Threatens Pulitzer Prize Winner. There's a link in that article to this petition. And I do urge people to sign this petition.
So when are we likely to hear then about whether the Supreme Court's going to take up James Risen's appeal?
Well, I think we're going to hear within a month, because the Supreme Court usually closes down for the summer by you know, the first couple of weeks of June, and if they don't, and they'll let us know by then whether they're going to take this appeal or not. And so, you know, it's time now for people to go sign this petition, stand up for freedom of the press, stand up against President Obama and Eric Holder's efforts to intimidate the press and to intimidate whistleblowers.
And just in closing, where is what's James Risen up to now? You know, who's paying his incredibly high bills? Illegal bills have got to be astronomical.
Well, he's still working for the New York Times. I don't know whether the Times is supporting him. I sure hope they are. Mm-hmm. But, he's getting the full support of his paper and also the Washington Post and other professional journalist organizations. But I can only imagine what those legal fees are.
But he's still able to work as a reporter.
He's still working at the Times, yeah.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Matthew Rothschild. And again, listeners can sign the petition by going to progressive.org and clicking on your article, Obama Threatens Pulitzer Prize Winner.
That's right, and thanks so much for having me, Ian.
It's a pleasure. Again, I've been speaking with Matthew Rothschild, who's a senior editor of the Progressive magazine published in Madison, Wisconsin. He's one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in this country and is the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. His latest article at progressive.org is Obama Threatens Pulitzer Prize Winner. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about chasing the American dream at a time when the 1% rules America. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now are Dr. Mark Rank, who's a professor of social welfare at Washington University, St. Louis. He is widely recognized as one of the foremost experts and speakers in the country on income inequality, poverty, and social justice. And also joining us is Thomas Herschel, who's a professor of development sociology at Cornell University. He's the director of the Population and Development Program, coordinator of the program, Work Team on Poverty and Economic Hardship, and director of the Teen Assessment Project. Together, they are the co-authors with Kirk Foster of the new book, Chasing the American Dream, Understanding What Shapes Our Fortunes. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Mark Rank and Thomas Herschel.
Thanks for having us on, Ian.
Yeah, thank you.
And let me begin with Mark Rank. Obviously, Mark, the issue of income inequality is out there in the political zeitgeist, and it's clearly going to be an issue in this forthcoming election in this year in November. Midterm elections, of course, the turnout's never usually half of what it is in presidential elections, but it could be a very critical issue, particularly with the Democrats. So far, how odd do you think the political world is adopting, absorbing, and reacting to the work that you and your co-authors have done?
Well, I think there has been some attention focused on it. President Obama in December made a speech, a pretty important speech on the whole issue of economic inequality, and he cited some of the work that Tom and I have done on poverty. That is, that over half of adults can expect at some point to spend at least 1 year below the poverty line. So I think some of it is starting to get attention, and you're right, this is a very important issue that's becoming, you know, one of the major political topics out there.
But my understanding, Tom Herschel, was that before your book came out, the AP did a story, and I remember interviewing you at the time, saying that up to, 80% of Americans at one point in their lives experience poverty, or at least the potential for homelessness and hunger?
That's correct, Ian. We set up a sort of a, Mark and I set up an economic adversity scale, which was unemployment, use of the social safety net, and poverty or near poverty. And we found out that 80% of the people in the country experience one of those events at least once, and most people experience it more than once. And I think what this is kind of getting at is this question of, you know, we really need to start to look at cause and effect. What is the cause of this? And then really try to deal with this effectively, because people, I think, are being affected by it, but maybe they're not admitting it to their neighbors or even to themselves. And this is something that really needs to be brought into the light of public discourse.
But you would think that if 4 out of 5 Americans have experienced that kind of vulnerability and face these prospects of hunger and homelessness and unemployment, you would think that this would be a walk-in for in this election year for whoever picks up this subject matter. But my understanding is that what's likely to happen in this midterm election is that all of the Republicans are likely to show up, and the president himself has been complaining about complacency amongst the Democrats and saying they have a congenital defect, and that is that they don't show up in midterms. So is it simply an unfortunate fact that the people who have most to gain from voting because their interests aren't being addressed are the least likely to show up? In other words, even if you discount the idea that 4 out of 5 people have faced poverty and hardship, you would think that at least, you know, there'd be some statistics that indicate that there'd be enough motivation on the part of these people to vote, but apparently they don't.
Right. I think voting is sometimes seen as a symbolic thing. It's also, there are constraints on voting. You know, some states are setting up laws, identification laws to try to discourage people from, try to keep the turnout down. And I think there's a lot of politics going on. One of the most fundamental things, I think, is that big money is really, has a lot to say about both political parties. And so you have a situation where the people that have the most influence tend to be the better off people in society. So politics tends to reflect that kind of dynamic. And I think, however, I think that is starting to change. And I think the, Obama, what Mark said earlier about Obama acknowledging our work in one of his talks, that's what that's getting at, that people are saying, yeah, we do need to start to talk about this, but we're not really very far down the road yet.
So, Mark Rank, what is your explanation for why it is that so many Americans have experienced the portent of poverty, homelessness, and unemployment, 4 out of 5, that's an awful lot, and yet somehow that doesn't translate in voting, that people don't show up and vote in their interests?
Well, there's been a lot of work on that. A person by the name of Robert Frank wrote a book a long time ago on why people tend not to vote their economic interests. And his thesis was that people are voting on social grounds rather than economic grounds. So they're socially conservative and voting for, in this case, the Republican Party, which is probably not in their best economic interest. So you have that. You also have in our research, what we show is that while a lot of people will experience economic insecurity and poverty, most folks do so for a fairly short amount of time. So it may be also that people think, well, I got through that. Others can get through it as well. So that may be part of it.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Mark Rank, who's professor of social welfare at Washington University, St. Louis. He's widely recognized as one of the foremost experts and speakers in the country on income inequality, poverty, and social justice. And also joining us is Thomas Herschel, a professor of development sociology at Cornell University. He's the director of the Population and Development Program, coordinator of the program work team on poverty and economic hardship, and director of the Teen Assessment Program. Together, they are the co-authors with Kirk Foster of the new book, Chasing the American Dream: Understanding What Shapes Our Fortunes. So just to touch, to get back to your book and leave the leave the politics to the voters in November, whether or not they show up, what's your sense then, Mark Rank, of why it is then that given these horrendous statistics that you have uncovered and shown us, why is it that people aren't more angry at the basic injustice? I mean, the idea that one family in America, the Walton families, all of whom through an accident of birth ended up inheriting the Walmart fortune, and together this family
its wealth is equal to, my understanding, the bottom 40% of all working American families. It would seem to me that when, you know, and by the way, the president just spoke at a Walmart the other day, congratulating them on going green without talking about the fact that they don't pay their workers a living wage. So what's your understanding of the lack of outrage?
Well, I think one reason is, and we get to this in a sense in thinking about what the American dream is that America has always had a strong theme of individualism and self-reliance, and that you make it on your own, that you're able to climb that ladder of opportunity, and there's a strong belief in that. Now, whether that's true or not, that's something that we look at in the book, and we actually find that there's a lot of volatility, both up and downward mobility. But, you know, people believe, and this came through in many of the interviews that we did, people believe that with enough hard work and effort that they will, in their life, be able to do okay and to achieve the American dream. So I think part of the reason for that there isn't more outrage is that our country is really steeped in the notion of individualism and self-reliance.
So, Thomas Herschel, do you think, though, that there is any evidence that the Horatio Alger myth is operating, given the oligarchical nature of our society and how much inherited wealth is passed on and how much of it's concentrated?
Well, I think what Mark said is really important, that we need to understand kind of the foundation of where the country is coming from. I think the country is also changing very rapidly right now, especially given the high-tech society that we're entering into, where we have, you know, computers that can begin to replace the labor of people in the workforce. That's one really important dynamic that's been sort of set loose. And so I think, and we do see a lot of people, I mean, what Mark said is really important, but I think if you sort of scan the news now, you see something like, for example, from one side of the political spectrum, the Tea Party saying, it's not just enough for me to vote for Republican. I want to change the rules of the game and, you know, shrink the government or whatever. And you have movements like the Moral Monday movement in North Carolina and some of the other southern states, where people are saying this system is immoral, and they're going down to the courthouse, and you know, over 1,000 people have been arrested. So I think that we are beginning to see these kind of flashes of consciousness, that people are saying, yes, we have these ideas, and really the American dream is kind of this idea that if I do my work and I play by the rules, I'll get ahead. And people are saying, well, I think the Occupy movement was also another expression of that. You know, the people have been out on the labor market after graduating from college, and they still haven't got they haven't found stable employment. So I think people are beginning to question the way this system is working. And so I think we hope that our book will add to that discussion significantly.
Although I will add to what Tom said, that we did find at the very top end, there's actually a fair amount of fluidity of folks that hit some of those high-end points of the income distribution. So one statistic that's gotten picked up in recent news is that we looked at the percentage of the population who at some point would find themselves in the top 1% of the income distribution, and we found that 12% of the overall population will at some point between 25 and 60 find themselves in the top 1%. So the idea that the 1% is a static group that's there and it's the same people year in and year out is really an incorrect view. It's much more fluid than what a lot of people imagine.
Well, there's one exemplar of the 1%, and I certainly don't want to tar the rest of America's billionaires with the same brush as Donald Sterling, but there's, I must say, you're dealing with a really sleazy sociopath there.
Well, I don't have any research evidence in terms.
Well, I tell you, I know it's sort of I'm blindsiding you with a somewhat irrelevant question, but I would just, you know, as a journalist, that just offends me so much that CNN offers this guy a platform. You know, this sort of totally disgusting reptile of a human being. You know, it's just all it does is make you sort of even more angry at the idea that these are people that we consider newsmakers. But back to the subject at hand here, let me ask you, Mark Rank, what would you then consider given that so much of the propaganda about the American dream that keeps this myth alive in the face of evidence to the contrary, what could you identify in our country as a real meritocracy?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I, as you were talking, I was thinking, really, one thing that we should be clear about is what is the American dream? And in our book, we talk about three aspects of the American dream that sometimes people don't necessarily think about immediately when they think of the American dream, but they turned out to be really important. The first aspect is that people are able to really follow their passions and follow their interests and to really reach their full potential, whatever that may be. That's one aspect. The second aspect is what Tom talked about earlier, that if you work hard, you should be able to be economically secure and raise a family and do okay from an economic perspective. And the third really important element of the American dream is the idea of hope and optimism. That is, that things will get better in my life, they'll get better in my children's lives, and that I will be able to address positively in the future challenges that I face. And that's a third big component of the American dream. So, you know, I think that this is really the heart and soul of the country. This is a really important aspect, and that's why, you know, when we talk to people, they were very strong about that this is an important element of America, and we seem to be losing this, and this is really, really a critical issue. It's, you know, as important as the issue of economic inequality that we were talking about earlier.
So, Thomas Herschel, would you consider the U.S. military to be a meritocracy?
Well, I think the U.S. military has been very carefully inculcated kind of a multicultural leadership. So you have a leader like Colin Powell, for example, that's a very important part of America's foreign policy, that you have a kind of affirmative action program. And I think actually, no. But my answer to you is no, though. That what you really have is it's an apparent means of economic mobility for the poor, and it's a very unfair system that we're fighting these wars since 2003, and it's basically an economic draft. The people that face this choice of, well, do I go to college and go into debt because my family certainly can't afford the bills? Do I go get a job where I'm not going to get ahead, a low wage job, or do I go in the military and risk, you know, going into harm's way? And so I think, no, it's actually a very unfair system that we have right now.
Well, Dr. Mark Rank, surely the college and student debt that Thomas just brought up, isn't that a huge drag on social mobility in this country if the younger generation are indentured? And one of the most outrageous things that goes on in Washington, which I've done some coverage on, is these for-profit colleges that take your taxpayer money, advertise incredibly, saturate the airwaves with these bogus new colleges that come out of nowhere, and get these kids indentured for life on basically by borrowing money from the government and then charging it back to these kids at enormous interest rates. Many of these kids are expiring minorities and veterans. And then, you know, they find that they have a worthless diploma and a lifetime of debt. I just don't understand how that kind of onerous outrage that is so much, it's a bipartisan scandal in Washington. The for-profit college people have a massive and powerful lobby, and, you know, yet they are the antithesis of the American dream. They're the ones that are killing the dream.
Right, and even to go back further than that, if we think about the quality of education that children are getting in primary and secondary schools, It's the United States is unusual in that we fund much of our schooling on the basis of local property tax. And so you have this wide discrepancy in the quality of education that students are getting. Some students are getting a superb education. Others who are living in poor neighborhoods and so on and so forth are getting a substandard education. And that's simply un-American. You know, we say with liberty and justice for all. We don't say for liberty and justice for some or for most. It should be for all. And if it means for all, then we need to address this educational discrepancies that you're talking about at the higher level and also at the primary and the secondary school levels.
So, Thomas Herschel, In terms of, you know, you mentioned the idea that 4 out of 5 Americans at some point or other, this is what your studies come up with, that have faced unemployment, poverty, and hunger. And so they've all, you know, 4 out of 5 of our fellow citizens have stared into the abyss. So is there a sense then that we are able to come up with ideas of how to employ people? You mentioned earlier the changing sort of globalized workforce, et cetera, and the possibility of computers and robots taking over. What's your sense of whether or not there's any creative thinking going on the future of work?
I think this question you're asking, Ian, is absolutely central. That, you know, that's what our book is designed to do. We need to start, you know, having a Democrat. There are elites talking about this in think tanks in Washington, D.C. This is, you know, the future of the labor market is a very central question. And the labor market's been shrinking as a percent of the population since the year 2000. And it really went down in 2000 when the 2007-08 recession hit. And it hasn't come back up again at all significantly. So I think this is actually something that we're not doing anything about in any kind of creative way. And I think one of the things we need to recognize is that people's self-worth is really a function of their ability. People want to contribute to society. Americans, this thing of, you know, I want to work hard, but I want to feel secure for that. People want to contribute something. They want to contribute their special skill, their idea. And I think that we need to begin to set up a system that really is able to account for people's contributions.
Well, Dr. Mark Rank and Thomas Herschel, I thank both of you for joining us here today.
Thanks for having us, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Mark Rank, who is professor of social welfare at Washington University, St. Louis. He is widely recognized as one of the foremost experts and speakers in the country on income inequality, poverty, and social justice. And also joining us was Thomas Herschel, professor of development sociology at Cornell University. He's the director of the Population and Development Program, coordinator of the program work team on poverty and economic hardship, and director of the Teen Assessment Program. Together, they are the co-authors with Kirk Foster of the new book, Chasing the American Dream, Understanding What Shapes Our Fortunes. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.